The audio recording going on this. One of the treats of being able to do this is to get a chance to summon people and to therefore get a chance to meet them. Because we've been looking forward to meeting this lady for several years now, and the same goes for everybody who is here from the 78L, because I've had a lot of people saying, is she here yet? Is she here yet? And she just arrived literally about 15, 20 minutes ago, Donna Halper. Several years ago, I came across some postings on some of the OTR old-time radio listings from Don and also from Elizabeth McLeod, and I persuaded both of them to join us over at the 78L, and Donna protested, I'm not a record person, I'm a broadcast person, a radio person, and then she proved that those words were wrong when we started seeing some behind the scenes postings or postings about the behind the scenes activities at Grey Gull Records. And she, being in the Boston area, was able to ferret out information that had been question marks for those of us in the record and for many years. But every once in a while, she does remind us that that she's still in the learning curve on records. Because, for example, I talk about speakerphones all the time, and you remember if you hadn't been familiar with speakerphones, the presentation I gave several years ago showed, of course, uncoated aluminums, and this had been confusing her because this is the speakerphone record that she knows of. And some of you could probably tell from even there that this is a Columbia pressing. And it, by golly, says Speakerphone Recording Company Incorporated, 171 Newbury Street, Boston, Massachusetts. There's a matrix number, SOP1A. Actually, it's dots in between. It's, WEEI, Big Brother Club, Dave Emery?
Bob Emery,
yeah. Side one and side two. Very, very wide lead-ins, and there's a groove in here which indicates this is probably the outer diameter of what the original aluminum was. I haven't, be interesting to play this and to see how this thing tracks, because this might be I said to
me
to.
I put side one on cassette.
But to see it track, to see whether this might really be just a pressing made from an uncoated aluminum original master.
We played it last week. It's pretty worn down after all these years, but believe it or don't, it plays. It was a promotional thing that Big Brother did to give away in a contest. And he was always doing stuff to give away. He was very promotionally minded. I just thought it was interesting that he had the presence of mind to go with what was, at that point, a brand new company. Speakerphone had just come to Boston in 1929. They appeared in the Boston phone book.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is extraneous to the talk. I just wanted to show
this talk. We're going to talk about Grego.
That's
not having a conversation.
Yeah, speakerphone. That's. Let me give you the introduction here for those of you not on the 78L, and actually for those of you on the 78L, as to who she is. Donna's on the journalism faculty at Emerson College in Boston. She teaches ethics, media criticism, and media history. She's run her own radio and management consulting firm since 1980. Her company's music library software is used by radio stations all over the world. She's written a number of magazine articles about the history of broadcasting, especially as it pertains to women and minorities, a frequent contributor to several media history websites, the OTR Digest, things like that. She's currently compiling her third book, Social History of Women in Broadcasting, to be published by M.E. Sharp. She spent 12 years on the air as an announcer, also worked in the music industry. She discovered the rock group Rush, who dedicated their first two albums to her. I don't know whether it's one of the ones I saw while record hunting this week. Ms. Halper is one of the editors of the Boston Radio Archives, collects memorabilia related to the people and companies that were involved with broadcasting in New England. In her spare time, she's a big sister and tutors immigrants in English as a second language. So here, Don Halper.
Thank you.
in person.
Thank you. First of all, let me make sure people can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Cool, that's a good sign. Okay. Secondly, it would be real useful to me if I could have pick one, a table, a chair, a something, so I can kind of lay my notes out, because with Grey Gull, this is an enigma wrapped around a puzzle, wrapped around, it's, they wrote a song about this a few years ago, it was called How Bizarre, and, but I have something that just about nobody has. I have the financial records of Grey Gull Records. You don't know what I had to do to get them. Do you know those commercials for, who is it, MasterCard, where it says, you know, a trip to Brazil, $3,400, dinner at a pub, $6,500, Grey Gull stock, worthless. And I have proof, because I went to the probate court and got the wills of all the people in Theodore Shaw's family, and found out that he had paid a number of them in Grey Gull stock. Imagine their surprise. But if you'll give me about 30 seconds to just lay a few things out, which is probably not professional, but I'll just do this anyway, because there's no other way to do it. Once upon a pond in a kingdom far away, probably in Boston, Massachusetts, there lived a very distinguished family. And every distinguished family has its black sheep, as we will see. But I don't think that Theo started out to be a black sheep. I think that he really believed in what he was doing. Okay, in fairness to him, I think he had a number of ideas about how things ought to be. And when they didn't turn out that way, he just got angry at the industry, which, you know, doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but it evidently made sense to him. So, as I said, give me a second while I just go off mic here and spread out a couple of things. Can you still hear me even though I'm not on mic? Okay, because I was on the radio for years, so I'm sort of used to just projecting, as it were. In 1882, Theodore Shaw was born, and that's always a good sign, because you can't give a talk about somebody who wasn't born. But when he was born, he was part of an extremely distinguished family that you have heard of. If you've been to the movies, and you saw the movie Glory, you're familiar with Robert Gould Shaw? That was a cousin. The Shaw family had been in Boston for generations. They were extremely prominent, they were extremely wealthy, they were extremely distinguished. And they were also very involved in charitable endeavors, they were involved in art, poetry, theater. In fact, at Harvard University, the Theater Arts Collection, that is one of the best in the country, was founded by and curated by Theo Shaw's father, Robert, for a number of years. If you go there, you will see that there's a thank you that is given to Robert Shaw. Robert had five kids, of whom Theo was one. Robert Jr. was another. You may say, so what, Donna? Well, at the time, you're right, so what? But later on, all of these people are going to be involved in Grey Gull Records. How unfortunate for them. But as I said, I think that when they started out, they really thought they were going to be on the cutting edge. When Theo graduated from Harvard, all of the Shaws, all of the male Shaws, because this is the era where females were expected to marry and the guys in the family were expected to go to Harvard. I must tell you that the book I'm working on about the history of women in broadcasting indicates very strongly that that was not always the case. There were lots and lots of women who very quietly on their own did in fact get an education, and we'll talk about them in passing. But the Shaw family was very traditional in that regard, so Theo and all of his brothers went to Harvard, where they all graduated and all went into various of the family businesses, which were mainly banking. They were your basic stereotypical Brahmin family. They were involved in trusts and wills and administering large accounts for businesses. Beacon Trust had about three of them working there, etc. But that wasn't for Theo. Theo just did not have his heart in trusts and wills. So he decided that he was going to explore some other options. Now, when you're exceedingly wealthy, you can do that. So first he decided to explore Europe. Well, that's an option. And so he wandered around Europe, I guess trying to find himself. And evidently he succeeded because he came back and took a job working for a company that had a baseball magazine. Well, the baseball magazine folded in 1 month. That would be typical of his career, from what I've been able to gather. Meanwhile, he goes to work for Houghton Mifflin in the publicity department, finds that publicity appeals to him. He likes doing publicity, and decides that he's going to start an advertising agency. I have never yet, and I've been working on this for 3 years, I have not been able to find one client who would admit that they ever had him as their publicist. And Lord knows I've tried. But we have to assume that he got clients from somewhere because he opened up an office in Chicago. Why Chicago? Another one of life's mysteries. But he found a job in Chicago and opened up an advertising agency. And while he was there, he met another gentleman named Marcus Lucius Quinn, who decided to open up a conservatory of music. Now picture this, if you will. A correspondence school conservatory of music. The two of them are perfect for each other, okay? I mean, if BS were cement, they could both pave a highway from here to San Francisco. I'm serious. But the two of them go into business together. Theo becomes the treasurer of the mythical Marcus Lucius Quinn Correspondence School of Music. And Marcus Lucius, who really does exist and lives in Newton later on, Newton, Massachusetts, which is about 5 or 6 miles out of Boston, Marcus Lucius makes Theo an officer in his company, and Marcus Lucius becomes an officer in Grey Gull. And from what I can gather, being an officer in Grey Gull is one of those rare honors that someday you can tell your children about and they'll say, "Why did you do that?" What's interesting about any of this, though, is that for some odd reason, they come back to Boston. They come back to Boston and decide to open up the same two businesses here. Now, there's no Grey Gull yet. Grey Gull has not been invented. There is, however, this advertising agency, as I said, and this mythical school of music. They both get an office in Dorchester, which is somewhat outside of Boston. Dorchester, at that point in time, is kind of a farming community. They actually have, what do they call those things? Like troughs where the horses can just kind of stop every few minutes and do whatever horses do. And that also seems like it's perfect for Grey Gull and for the Marcus Lucius Quinn School of Music. I could very well be. Meanwhile, and this is kind of interesting if we're talking about the personality of somebody, Theo comes from this old line of Brahmins. But from what I can gather, and please don't be offended, keep in mind, this is 1913, he marries a Catholic. Now, in those days, for a Brahmin to marry a Catholic, would have been just as bad as if he'd married a Jew. But, no, I'm very serious. The society was incredibly stratified in those days. And it's interesting because as prominent as the family is, the wedding gets about one paragraph in several newspapers. It's kind of like, yes, this happened. No, we weren't there. You know, and, you know. But what's interesting is that despite the fact that from what we can gather, it was an intermarriage and they were married in the vestry, which, you know, back in those days, if you weren't both the same religion, you had to be married in the vestry. He and his wife, Lillian, stayed together, God, it was probably 60 years. From what we can gather, they had a very happy marriage. She was one of the few people that did understand him, and they never had kids, but they stayed together all those years, and she was, from what I can gather, quite a friend to him. Her name was Lillian, and she had been a manicurist when she met him. Why he met a manicurist, I don't know, but he met a manicurist. And the reason I know this is because in the one little story that was in the Boston Herald about it, it says, the young millionaire met a manicurist. And I'm like, ooh, well, we know why she married him. Okay. But as I said, it turned out to be a fairly good relationship. She stays out of the picture, though, as women very often did in those days. From what we can gather, she did a lot of charity work. In 1921, he got a very fancy schmancy house in Wellesley, where the family had been living anyway, and held on to that house for years, but he worked in Boston. Now, around 1919, that's when we first start seeing evidence that Grey Gull exists, okay? The Shaw Advertising Agency also continues to exist, but Grey Gull, there are a number of conflicting dates on Grey Gull. How many of you have ever tried to do research on Grey Gull? It's one of the most bizarre things you have ever had happen to you in your life. Every book, every magazine that I've ever seen that has tried to do discographies of Grey Gull have found that Theo had this tendency to use the same numbers but change the name of the group and put out the same song again. He had the tendency to like change the names of the bands relentlessly, but from what we can gather, it was like the same four or five core musicians that recorded for him all the time. And what's interesting about that is that a couple of them are quite good. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Mike Mosiello or with Andy Sinella, both of whom were quite respected. What they were doing with him remains one of life's mysteries, because he would develop a reputation for not paying his bills, for doing everything on the cheap. And yet, those two recorded with him, oh God, probably for about 7 years, and continued to do so until the label finally died a painful death. The formal beginning of Grey Gull Records, according to the state of Massachusetts, is December 31st, 1919. That's when he incorporated it. It would die a painful death long before the... we don't have a specific date of when it died a painful death, but to the state of Massachusetts, it died a painful death in 1934 when the corporation was dissolved officially, and I have the acts from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts about groups, you know, and organizations that had gone out of business. So if we want to really do exact dates according to Massachusetts, it's 1919 to 1934. But we have a lot of evidence that Grey Gull stopped doing much of anything long before 1934, and we'll get to that in a couple of seconds. The dates that we do have for Grey Gull, the October 3rd, 1919 date is when he allegedly trademarked the Grey Gull. And David, you brought some Grey Gulls along for people's listening and dancing pleasure. Most of them don't play, but never mind. Actually, they do sort of play if you like things that, yes, if you like things that snap, crackle, and pop, then Grey Gulls are for you. Yeah, just grab a Grey Gull and just show them what it looked like. I put a few of them on tape in no particular order, but we'll get to those in a couple of minutes. Can you kind of put one up there? Cool, let's see what happens. Ain't technology a wonderful thing?
This is the one that you're usually used to.
Yes. This is the one that most people have seen, with the sort of maroon, with the sort of fading label, with the... As I said, what's a shame is he really did have some good musicians playing for him.
It's a little clearer.
That one's a little better? Cool. No, come on, that's... Yep, there they are. He was also famous for not putting the names of any of the bands on his labels, so it's like, you figure out who these are. And some of the labels are, like, there's nothing on them. It's just Grey Gull recorded in Boston. And it's like, you figure out what this is. Uh-huh, who was quite talented. He actually, Von DeLeith, for reasons which I have no idea, did a Madison for him. He was evidently good at talking people into doing things for him.
Charleston Choo-Choo.
Yes.
Yes.
Did you want to show them some of the Talking Machine World ads with those?
Yes.
Okay. There's one. He did, for somebody that was in advertising, he did very, very little publicity for his own company, which I was rather surprised at, because I would have expected that, like, hey, you've got this great opportunity to publicize yourself. You say you're a publicist. Show us what you've got. From what we can gather, the only advertising he really did was in Talking Machine World and a few ads in the Boston Post, which, God willing, I have here somewhere. And if I can find them sometime today, we'll let you see some of them, which they are a very bizarre set of ads. Here's one, and again, my apologies for the condition of the microfilm. I've got a couple that are in better shape than that. Yes, reasons to buy Grey Gull. They're cheaper I'm serious. Yes. Yes, they're a huge success, and he said so. This is one of my own personal favorites, and this one is in fairly good condition. Yes, you can find gray gulls. Are you ready for this? You can find gray gulls at any service station. I'm not making this up. Yeah.
Sold by 800 stores in or near Boston.
Given away by 800 more.
Ask your druggist.
Hey, you know? Well, see, first they tranquilize you, and then they give you the gray gull. Yeah, it was different, to say the least. So we do see some of these, and of course, you know, the benefit of gray gull being made in Boston is supposed to be like, oh, okay, it's made in Boston. Well, then. It is true that for a while he did make his records in Boston. He had a factory right behind his office. And his office was on Dorchester Avenue, which was in South Boston. Theo was not where the action was. He was kind of down in the low rent district. But that's okay. I gather that it gave him the opportunity to have a little peace and quiet and do things the way he thought they ought to be done. The problem was that most of the reviewers and most of the people that were involved in the music industry, and by the way, speaking of what it had come to, by 1925 it had come to this. Yes, please, take my gray gulls, please. Exactly. Actually, it turned out to be for 2 or 3 weeks, and they still couldn't get rid of them. What is kind of too bad about that, like I said, is that there actually are some sides on Gray Gull that are halfway decent. Some of the Mosiello and Sinella stuff, there's some Clarence Williams that's quite good. But the problem, as everyone has noticed, is that they didn't last long. For all of his publicity about, you know, these are as long-lasting as any record in Boston. Well, Theo, you had the only record company in Boston. Unfortunately, long-lasting, from what old-timers tell me, meant about 2 or 3 plays, and then it started to deteriorate rather badly. To this day, many of us who have Gray Gulls kind of marvel at how bad they sound. And from what we're told, they sounded bad right from Jump Street. I don't understand that. That is always going to be one of the mysteries that confounds me about doing this research. This was not a stupid person. This was a guy who had been in business for a while, who had worked in 4 different cities, who was actually a reporter, a financial reporter for the New York Sun for a while. I mean, we're not talking about somebody who didn't know any better. But I guess he was relentless about doing things on the cheap. Now, for a while, Gray Gull actually did seem to make a few bucks. Looking at the financial records, we find that there were about 2 years when people really did try them, when people really did buy some of them, as a matter of fact. Unfortunately, we're talking about a very competitive industry, and we're talking about the fact that so many Gray Gulls were in the names of totally anonymous artists, and even back then, people were artist-oriented. In Boston at that time, you had a number of very good radio stations. I don't get a lot of evidence that they played nameless bands. I do get a lot of evidence that they played bands that they'd heard of. And in Boston, you had a number of bands that you'd heard of. Leo Reisman was getting his start in Boston around that time. Joe Rhines, the band leader Joe Rhines, got his start around that time. And for those who have never seen these good folks, I do believe that I have somewhere in the midst of this morass. There's Joe Rhines. That's the late, great Joe Rhines, who died in December of 1986, having been married to Portland Hoffa for a while. That's not what killed him, but he had a very, very long and successful career, starting in 1921 at Boston's first radio station, 1XE WGI. And WGI would be the home of a number of up-and-coming band leaders, and also a number of up-and-coming vocalists. I think we've got Hum and Strum on the other side. Yeah. Do any of you remember Hum and Strum? Yep. Max Zides and Tom Currier, God rest their souls, they got started out at 1XEWGI as well. So given the quality of the musicians, it is not surprising to me that why play a Grey Gull by the Hub Syncopators when you could play something by Joe Rines or something by Leo Reisman. This is a picture of WGI Studios, and they were out on Medford Hillside. That was our first radio station. And I must tell you that there is evidence that they were on the air before KDKA. I've documented that fairly thoroughly. It's one of my little crusades in life. I have nothing against KDKA, but publicity disguised as history gets me crazed, you know? So, you mean Peter Goldmark didn't invent story? Really? You know, I thought, oh, okay. It's amazing to me how much information is out there that has no correlation to anything. On the other side, there is a rare picture of, yes, I got to show you that. That gentleman, you should thank him at least once today, okay? We all know Babe Ruth, but the bald guy, that's the late, great John Shepherd III, one of radio's unsung heroes. Did any of you use FM in any of the past couple of days? Thank the late, great John Shepherd. Any of you listen to news? Thank the late, great John Shepherd. John Shepherd III was an entrepreneur. And I tell you this because these are the people that Theo Shaw is in competition with at this point in time. John Shepherd had a sense that radio was going to happen. So he put a radio station in his department store, the Shepherd Stores, and brought in some of the biggest and best musicians to play there. Name talent. He was one of the first people to pay bands in the era when, you know, if you could volunteer, if you had two arms and a fiddle, you could get on the radio. He insisted on big names. In 1927, he had the first all-female radio station. Really. He was the first person that I know of to put an all-black musical on the air. In November of 1922, he put Shuffle Along with Hubie Blake and Noble Sissle and Lottie G and all those folks. Put them right on the air and they did the music from Shuffle Along. No one had been doing things like that. He gave $50,000 to Edwin Howard Armstrong to do his FM research. And he was the one who funded the fight for credentials for radio journalists, because in the 1930s, only newspaper people were allowed to be credentialed journalists, and the late, great John Shepherd got his people from the Yankee Network credentialed, thereby leading to broadcast news. So these are the people that are out there really doing. Theo stays out in Dorchester being right about the fact that the industry doesn't understand him. And they didn't. So by and large, they ignored him. He had the ads in Talking Machine World. He had the ads in the Boston Post for a while. He was able to get one reporter to write about Grey Gull's studios. But they didn't mention him, and they didn't mention any of the artists. They just mentioned that they went out to the studios and that they saw how recording was being done there. And yep, it was a recording studio, all right. And that was it. Now, considering that the man was supposed to be a publicist, you have to ask yourself, why did he get so little publicity? But he seldom, if ever, did. I have, as I said, spent 3 years going through every ounce of microfilm of all of the 10 newspapers that Boston had. Do you know what eye strain I have at this point? But I'm serious. I found so little about him and about Grey Gull that I'm just utterly mystified. So it seems to me that his saying that the label was the fastest growing label and, you know, everyone is coming upon this good idea. One thing he did right, he was able to capitalize on some of the shows that were in town, like when Nellie Kelly came to town and was very successful and nobody had put out any records about it yet. He got his Nameless Wonders into the studio and they all did some songs from Nellie Kelly. But as soon as some of the majors did them with name artists, that was the end of that. So it kind of seems like the man was sort of a day late and a dollar short most of his Grey Gull career. Those of you that have seen Grey Gulls, and how many of you have? How many of you have, like, you yourselves have run into Grey Gulls? Yeah, what's your general impression of them? Very noisy. Very noisy. And the early ones, yeah, the first couple of years are actually halfway decent. But by the time you get to about 1924 or so, it becomes very difficult. Now, periodically, he was able to persuade somebody that was fairly well known to record for him. In 1925, they did a performance on WEEI. In fact, they had Grey Gull Night in May 4th of 1925, where Hall and Ryan performed. And that was, of course, John Ryan, not the John Ryan that was the, you know, Joe Ryan's doing dirty stuff, but a real honest-to-God Irish tenor named John Ryan. I have some Ryan on that tape if you want to run that a little bit. He was your typical Irish tenor. Yeah, it, theoretically it'll play. And it's Grey Gull, you never know. And this is a good Grey Gull. I'm not going to force you to listen to an entire song of this. You get the point. Yeah, I get the point too. Yes. Somewhere down the line, and you can fast forward it any place you want to fast forward it, there's a couple of dance tunes that are actually somewhat less staticky, but I did want you to hear a little John Ryan, because everyone should at least once in their life. The thing is, John Ryan was quite popular in his day, and when he performed on WEEI, he got all kinds of requests, and people wanted him to come back. They just didn't want to have to take on all the other Grey Gull artists as well. There's an article, in fact, several people have mentioned it. Arthur Hall, who had done some stuff with Grey Gull, mentioned, I think, years later that they never did pay him. And from what I can gather, that was very typical. Theo was always promising people big profits, so somewhere down the line, it's like, when we become profitable, we'll pay you. You're on the cutting edge. I don't think so. But in the meantime, the list of people that did record for Grey Gull, for Madison, for Radiex, a label that existed only in people's imagination. It had an address. Nothing was there. It was a vacant lot years ago. Okay? Went down to the Dorchester Historical Society. It's like, what used to be at 598 Dorchester Avenue? Yep, nothing. It's like, oh, okay. So really, pretty much everything operated out of that 135 Dorchester Ave place. See if we can find a couple of the dance tunes on there. There's a couple of things on there that are halfway decent. But I got these from a collector friend of mine who, like, babied them, and that's as good as you get. I wish I could tell you that there's an answer to why he did it that way. But here's what I do know about why he stopped doing it that way. Around 1929, the money man, who was his father, got tired of pouring money down. Also in 1931, Theo's brother dies. And they were the two officers of Grey Gull Records. Now, Theo immediately does what you would expect him to do. He goes to court to try to get their estates. And I have the court papers. He tries to get himself declared executor and pretty much tries to get unfrozen the funds that seem to have been frozen. No luck. His brother, Hollis, gets to be the administrator and is very clear that the family has spent about as much money on Grey Gull as they're going to spend. 1929-1930 is the last time we see any Grey Gull records that we know were actually made anyplace. I believe Van Dyke was still issuing sides at that point in time. later on, you're going to see records shipped to England, you're going to see records in Woolworths for 10 cents, you know, they're going to be everywhere. But I don't get any evidence at all that after 1930, any are really made. Pretty much they just kept reissuing what they had under different names. In 1931, like I said, the money ran out completely. By 1932, we're in the midst of the Depression. A lot of businesses are failing. And from what I can gather, there is no more Grey Gull even on paper because the office ceases to exist. The real address of Theo's ad agency, gone. But Theo is an inventive fellow, and he reinvents himself 5 years later. So Grey Gull goes out of business in 1934 officially, but really it probably went out of business around 1932. 1935, he reappears as an art critic. Well, why not? And starts writing books about the problem in society is art critics. Other art critics. He's the only honest art critic. And he writes three books, that several of which are reviewed by people who read them and said, this book probably has some point to it, but we can't figure out what it is. Nobody to this day understands why he was so angry at art critics. Maybe art critics are synonymous with the people who put down Grey Gull. Maybe the art gallery that he inherited from his father, maybe the kinds of paintings he wanted in his art gallery were not the kind that you should have, but he was a very angry person for the entire rest of his life. How do I know this? I have the form that he filled out for Harvard for their reunion. And some of the answers are just incredible. This is a man who all his life felt like no one respected him and no one understood him, and he really just kind of lashes out at Harvard for some odd reason. I'm going to, if I can for a second, grab something here. If I put it in here, I don't know if I did or not, I may have pulled it. Here we go. This is, to my knowledge, the only picture of Theodore Lyman Shaw that exists. Captions are welcome. Now, that was taken, pretty good, huh? Actually, the number is his Harvard number. This was for the Harvard reunion, and they showed me how they did the mock-up of the, 40th anniversary yearbook and so on and so on. Let me read you some of his answers, if I may, to the questionnaire they asked him to fill out. Do you subscribe to the Harvard Alumni Bulletin? Never. Do you read the annual report? No. Do you maintain an interest in the college? Slight. Do you belong to the local Harvard Club? Yes. What courses that you took at Harvard proved most useful to you? Mathematics. Do you read books by Harvard professors? Not intentionally. In what sports do you engage? Golf occasionally. What has been your hobby? Oil painting. What has been your greatest achievement? I'm still alive. What do you consider to be the durable satisfactions of your life? I have none. Now, you look at that and you think to yourself, here's a guy who was a millionaire, who had a number of famous artists who gave him a chance and recorded with him, who had the opportunity to really make a name for himself, who ran an art gallery for years, who wrote three books, and yet at the end of his life, he says that his only satisfaction is that he's still alive and that he has no achievements that have really lasted for him. I think that's kind of too bad. When he retired, he continued to be in the art industry. He continued to run a gallery. But what's interesting is he never mentioned Grey Gull. considering that it was 15 years of his life, whether it was a success or a failure, you would have thought the guy would have at least mentioned that he did it. But not only didn't he mention it, but no one in his family ever mentioned it either. I have the biographies for Harvard of every single member of his family that attended Harvard, including the treasurer and the vice president of his corporation. None of them mention it. And in fact, in one of his own, he says, I've just opened a talking machine business to manufacture talking machine records, Grey Gull, but I'm not sure it will be successful. He was right. In the final analysis, the fascination of Grey Gull is, I suppose, they're so bad that they're good. When Theo died, he died in 1975, he, as I said, had no children. In his will, he said that he was leaving everything that he had, and the everything he had was pretty considerable. He had invested in stocks in those days, didn't invest in Grey Gull, but he certainly invested in the things that people conservatively invested in those days, you know, Sears, Ford Motor Company, things like that. Left his wife a very wealthy woman, but she died about 3 months later. They were both in their 80s by this point in time. But in his will, he says, I leave everything to my wife. If my wife dies, I leave it to Mass General Hospital for them to put into charities that I would approve of. I have not figured out what those charities would be. What I have figured out is that the 3 years that I've spent researching this company have been kind of a labor of love, and the things that I found out maybe have not solved the mystery of Grey Gull. Like, for example, not only did some people get stock in Grey Gull, but some people got stock in a company that some of you have heard of called National Phonograph Company. Now, I am not sure what the connection between Grey Gull and National Phonograph Company is, but when Theo's brother died, he had stock from that company. Like Grey Gull, it was worthless. Looked great on a piece of paper, though. I've seen it. Beyond that, Theo spent the rest of his life basically fighting in the courts to become administrator of every single one of his relatives' estates when they died off. But as I said, he died in 1975, never mentioning even once that he had been involved with Boston's only record company. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
You told us on the list about the...
Don't believe it.
What I think is a very innovative marketing system, and these ads tell a little bit about that. Could you talk about the local dealers?
Oh, yeah. Actually, all joking aside, the thing about the service stations, in the early days of radio, as I'm sure you know, there was no such thing other than the major chains. There was no such thing as a record store per se. I mean, here we have an ad for Victor Records, and I want you to notice where they're being sold. At Nathan's Furniture Store. Now, I mean, you'd go into Nathan's Furniture Store for your Victor Records. Actually, you would, because they were, of course, also selling the phonographs and so on and so on. But that was very common. You would see grocers selling records. You would see electric shops all the time sold records. But very often, I have ads here that are for stores that I would never expect them to sell records, and some that I would. Some of them are quite classy. I mean, here's your $100 Columbia Graphinola, and if you buy one, you get 12 records. 12. A dozen. And here's a couple more Grey Gull ads, which are Grey Gull Records, fastest selling records in New England. Yep, they went out gold and they came back platinum. But yeah, what he did was he put up racks in various stores where people could just kind of help themselves. They could take one, they could play it, they could sample it. First time it played, it sounded fine. So, you know, people would buy them and say, oh, this is kind of cool. Take it home and, oh, mommy, what have I done wrong? But it really was a very innovative scheme at a time. Here are the Nellie Kelly things. At a time, and I apologize for the really bad condition of the photocopies, but like Greg L. Records, the Boston Post didn't age very well either, and he did most of his advertising in the Post.
Why walk a mile for a record that isn't as good as a Greg L. when you can buy Greg L. right at your neighborhood store?
Yes.
Comfort of dealing with a store where you are known and save money as well. 1,800 drugstores, variety stores,
yep.
and music stores in New England carry the record.
Absolutely. The thing is, though, he seemed to think that there was a benefit to the records being local. Now, bad records, whether they're local or national, aren't going to do that well. But he seemed, and this was an era when everyone had a gimmick. I mean, Vocalion, the red records, you know, red records are better. Why are red records better? I asked that on the list. I'm like,
yeah.
You know, I'm a dummy. What do I know? You know, I mean, like, I should buy these red records? You know, so Theo really did have a good concept in terms of telling people, like, hey, this is a local company, support your local business. Unfortunately, that seems to have been the only benefit that he could offer people, because the people that were recording for him didn't have names that anyone recognized, and the quality of the records didn't stand up. But it is a true fact that he was one of the first retailers to get the idea that if you sold your records everywhere, sooner or later, I mean, he probably did sell them in service stations, I mean, gasoline stations. It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
I think what that means there is not, you know, real automobile service stations, but Greg Gold service.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm saying I have evidence that he really did go throughout Dorchester and throughout various other places, just handing out Grey Gull racks and saying, hey, would you sell some of these in your store? And they were like, well, sure, why not? You know, money for me. Absolutely, absolutely. Couple of questions, yes, sir. Absolutely, absolutely doing it on consignment, yes. Yes. Exactly, exactly. And as I said, that's what happened, because I have the feeling that the first couple probably did sell on curiosity, and also because he really did capitalize on a few good people. But I think as time went on, the output didn't justify the interest, and people started saying, well, why do I want these in my store when I could have Pathé, I could have Victor, you know, I can have Columbia, Brunswick, et cetera, and he just couldn't compete. The other thing is, the places I would have expected him to go, he didn't go. I haven't seen one review of his stuff in the Boston Herald. You may say, well, big deal. Very big deal. The reviewer for the Herald reviewed everything that came across her desk. Her name was Catherine Lyons. She was a music junkie in the 1920s. And she had this column that were just like, you know, here are the records that I got this week, and here's what I think of them. And people were fascinated. You know, they didn't know. They figured, hey, you're a music critic for a newspaper? Wow, you must be cool. And each of the newspapers had a music critic. I've never yet seen a critique of a Grey Gull record. I haven't seen them in Variety. Now, I can't believe it's because he didn't bring them. Maybe some of the local columnists had a little deal where they only wrote about Victor and Brunswick and Pathé, but I can't believe that either. If something were that good, I would think they'd want to write about it. No one does, though. Yeah.
They would have written about
it if they don't have advertised. Bingo. That was my sense. Although he did advertise in the Boston Advertiser, which was a real newspaper, and they gave him, like, one line about Grey Gull Night on WEEI. And, you know, so just advertising is no guarantee of anything either. There's got to be more to it. He advertised in the Post faithfully for about 3 months. Post never mentions him, leading me to believe there's more to it than that. And it may also have been a personality clash, too, just based on his ideas about how things ought to be done. He did kind of have a certain imperiousness about him, and I gather that some of the local record people knew how to kiss up. Theo was not going to kiss up, thank you so much. He was going to do it his way till the day he died, and he did. Yes? Probably whoever he could get for cheap. Interestingly enough, the Marcus Lucius Quinn Conservatory provided him with a number of real honest-to-God local people from the Strand Theater. He really did use a lot of just got out of college, graduated from music school, looking for something to put on my resume kinds of people. And I gather there were a couple of people who were fairly well known in the Boston music scene, but I can't get anybody to admit to having worked for, I'm not trying to be snide here. I'm just like, I've asked some of the old timers. I'm like, there are a few of these sides that are actually halfway decent. Who arranged them? And I was like, not me. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, I'm going to stumble on who worked for him. I'm sure there was, and I'm just because of the fact that, like, Andy Sinella, he wasn't no dummy. He went on to work for NBC, and I've got pictures of him in Radio Digest in the 1930s. He had an orchestra for NBC. Now, I mean, this guy knew what he was doing. So clearly there were professionals involved with him, because I don't get the sense that Theo knew anything about music. I get the sense that he just signed the occasional paycheck. But Andy and Mike got paid. We know this, okay? Just because of how long they stuck around and they didn't work for anybody else. They did a lot of session work. So it would seem to me that there had to be professionals involved. And if any of you happen to know anything more about Mike Mosiello or Andy Sinella than I've been able to dig up, I would be real grateful, because there's got to be a living relative out there somewhere, and there's a link there. I am sure that one of those two had something to do with his better sessions, because they were two class guys. Anything else I can tell you? You've been a wonderful audience. I hope I haven't been horribly boring, and I'm very, very grateful for your time. Thank you.
We'll meet back here in an hour, and I just want to mention...